Welcome, those of you who are watching this live and perhaps listening to it after the fact. This is the Mises Academy class, Mises on Money and Banking, and this is the office hours session for the third week. And as always, I'll turn it over to the people who are attending it live. One comment before we get going. I have been scheduling these office hours later in the evening simply because my son is on a basketball team and their schedule keeps bouncing around, so it's like I had to keep my whole Saturday morning and afternoon open so that there wouldn't be a conflict. But his last game is going to be next week, so in other words, after week four for this class, the office hours will probably be more in the late morning or afternoon, so in case you've been wanting to attend but didn't feel like giving up your weekend, that change will be coming starting in week five. Okay, Lewis asks, in the Theory of Money and Credit, page 106, Mises claims that it is certain that nowadays the value of gold is largely supported by its monetary employment and that its demonetization would affect its price in an overwhelming fashion. What do you think he might say about the evolution in the market value of gold over the past four decades since 1971? Would Mises possibly ascribe such rising market prices of the precious metal to the fact that it actually hasn't been entirely demonetized, given that in practice it remains the most important reserve asset in terms of its objective exchange value, besides its intertemporal qualities as a store of wealth and the like? Huh, that's a really good question. Let me go look up for a second. I remember him saying that, and I kind of just want to see what the context was of what does he mean by demonetization per se. So when you said that page 106, that was from the Mises Institute's PDF version. I don't know if you guys have been experiencing this, but for some reason when I try to open up the Mises Institute's PDF of Theory of Money and Credit, it's like real cumbersome. It's hard to like scroll through it. It goes very slowly. Case in point. All right, bear with me as I scroll through this thing. All right, well, this is moving. Let me just rephrase the question, make sure everyone understands. So Mises is saying let me put it to you this way. Now I'm at page 106. Let me just see if this is what you're talking about, Lewis. Okay, yeah, well, I can just read this to get everyone who's listening up to date. Okay, so Mises on page 106 says, it is impossible to say how far the present value of money depends on its monetary employment and how far on its industrial employment. When the institution of money was first established, the industrial basis of the value of the precious metals may have preponderated, but with progress in the monetary organization of economic life, the monetary employment has become more and more important. It is certain that nowadays the value of gold is largely supported by its monetary employment and that demonetization would affect its price in an overwhelming fashion. The sharp decline in the price of silver since 1873 is recognized as largely due to the demonetization of this metal in most countries. And when, between 1914 and 1918, many countries replaced gold by banknotes and treasury notes so that gold flowed to those countries that had remained on a gold standard, the value of gold fell very considerably. Okay, so what he's getting at there is, and I'll come to your good question, Lewis, but let me just make sure everyone knows what the issue is. So remember, originally, before there's money, it's got a bunch of goods that are valued in the exchange relationships for their use as consumption goods or production goods, and gold would have been one of those things. Now, people start engaging in indirect exchange, and so remember, what that does is it makes, before in the story of indirect exchange and how it emerges, we focused on the fact that the marketability would snowball, right? So if something was initially very marketable or very liquid or very saleable, now with the introduction of indirect exchange, more and more people are willing to accept that particular item, and so its marketability is enhanced. But at the same time, its exchange value would be enhanced too. So I haven't really talked about that before, but that is what's going on in this passage that Mises is talking about, right? So the point is, it's not merely that in the beginning, let's say, people realize that, oh, a lot of people like to, or, you know, there are a lot of people who would accept gold just for use as jewelry or whatever, and so now I'm willing to accept it as a medium of exchange, and so therefore now it becomes more acceptable to everybody. But it's also that gold's exchange value would go up. Because remember, marketability and exchange value are two different things, right? Remember, your house has a very high market value, but it's very illiquid, whereas, I don't know, a silver earring doesn't have as high a market value as your house, but it's much more liquid, right? If you had to sell it, you could get its market value very quickly, whereas the house, you'd have to put it on the market for a long time. Okay, so again, remember, liquidity, or what Menger, it's translated as saleability and exchange value, are different things. But when something becomes employed as a medium of exchange and then ultimately as money, its liquidity and its exchange value go up, because now people are demanding it, not just to use, like if we're talking about gold, people are demanding it in the marketplace. So the demand for gold has gone up, not only for people, jewelers who want to get gold and, you know, hammer it out into necklaces or whatever. I don't know how you make a necklace, but you get the point. For industrial applications, or people who want to, doctors who want to use it for arthritis treatments, and dentists who need to get some gold for fillings. But now there are private mints, and their business is they go out and they buy hunks of gold and stamp them into coins and give them to people, and then people, you know, keep them in their pockets or whatever, right? So if you're just thinking in terms of the gold miners who mine raw gold and sell it to people for various uses, well, now there's this humongous new use for gold, namely to turn it into coins and bars of gold bullion and so forth to be stored and used as money. So just like if there's a new use found for tobacco, that's going to raise the price of tobacco relative to other goods. It's the same thing with gold. So the fact that now you've got a lot of people holding gold to use it as money, that increases its market exchange value. And so Mises was saying in that passage that if for some reason we stopped using gold as money, then its value would fall. And so, and then he was given some historical examples of that principle. For example, at one point, remember, historically, gold and silver competed for being money. And so there are a lot of political battles over that. You've probably heard of the famous Cross of Gold speech and so on, the free silver movement, that kind of thing, demanding free coinage of silver. So those are the battles over what should the government designate as the official money. And so silver lost out in that struggle. for various reasons. And so the point is, if you looked at the exchange value of silver back when it could serve as money, and then after the fact when it no longer was money, and gold was, the value of silver relative to other things fell. And that made a lot of sense, because now people only were valuing silver for its use as jewelry or whatever else you're going to use silver for. People making bullets who are going to go fight werewolves. So, whereas, people weren't using it as much to hold as money. Okay, so then the question is, all right, well then, and then let me just also explain another part of the passage about during World War I, Mises says, a lot of the belligerent countries replaced gold with treasury, earth banknotes, and other things, and so then gold flowed to those countries that were still on the gold standard. So what he's saying there is a lot of countries during World War I, they went off the gold standard, and so they got their subjects, rather than carrying around gold coins in their pockets, they were just carrying around banknotes. And so what happened is the physical gold then flowed to those countries like the U.S. that were still officially on the gold standard. And so if you just think about it, in those countries, if there's an influx of gold now, it's like the demand to hold gold in those other countries went down, and then in the countries where they were still on the gold standard, there's this influx, the quantity of gold flowed in. So, thinking those two things are consistent with the idea that the price of gold now is going to go down, which is the same thing as saying the prices of other things quoted in gold will go up, which kind of makes sense because there's like now inflation, right? So that's what he's getting at, and I do know, so now Lewis's question, if gold was officially $35 an ounce in 1970, and then Richard Nixon closes the gold window in 1971 and takes the U.S. off the gold standard, shouldn't that have made the price of gold go down? Like, shouldn't the price of gold in 1975 have been, whatever, $27 an ounce, something like that? Because you would say, wait a minute, originally the U.S. Treasury or the Federal Reserve was stockpiling gold to back up the dollar. And so ultimately, gold really still was the world's money, but now it's not. Now it went to being the dollar, so shouldn't the price of gold collapse? And what's funny is but there were some big-gun economists. I don't want to name names because I can't remember for sure. Like, it were people of the caliber of Paul Samuelson or John Kenneth Galbraith, but I don't remember if it was those two guys specifically, so I don't want to say it was. But it was people of that level of notoriety and acclaim who I'm pretty sure were predicting that the price of gold was going to go down in the 70s, precisely for that reason. They thought that gold was being propped up by the dollar, and that once that tie had been broken, gold would just, sink back down to just being some industrial metal. And that, so in other words, they looked at it the other way around. From the way Austrians tend to look at it, these guys weren't normally Austrians say, "Oh, it was the dollar was being propped up by its link to gold, which was the real precious commodity." And then once Nixon closed the gold window and severed the link, now all of a sudden this worthless fiat money just starts getting debased because it's no longer linked to the real thing of value, gold. Where these sort of Keynesian guys were looking at it the other way around, they were saying the only thing propping up the gold price measured in dollars is the fact that you can always turn in an ounce of gold for $35. So that was put a floor, right? The dollar price of an ounce of gold couldn't go below 35 because you could always just go to the government, the U.S. government, and turn in an ounce of gold and get $35 in cash and paper currency. So you'd be silly to sell your hunk of gold to anybody for less than 35 because Uncle Sam was always there willing to buy it for 35. See, that's the way they were thinking of it, but the Austrians tend to look at the other way around, saying the only thing that was keeping the dollar's purchasing power where it was and letting the dollar maintain its rate of exchange against other currencies and other things, was that you could always turn in $35 to the U.S. government and get an ounce of gold. And so, you know, most Austrians interpreted it as the thing that was holding gold up, or the dollar up all those years, was that it was redeemable at the government's window. So, obviously what happened in practice was once they severed the link, the price of gold shot up. And, you know, quite rapidly, such that by, you know, 79, 1980, the price of gold was ridiculously high compared to what had been just in 1971. So clearly the Keynesian interpretation was wrong. It was not that the dollar was propping up gold, it was the other way around. The gold was the one thing that was maintaining the value of the fiat paper money, or I should say the paper money, and then once that link was gone, the value of the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar went down. So does that mess though with Mises with saying, I don't think so, because, and I think Lewis, you anticipated some of my answers here. For one thing, to say there was a demonetization of gold, it really wasn't. People were still holding gold as an asset, as you anticipated, Lewis, right? So it's not that the gold flowed out of the holdings of central banks and went into jewelry and stuff, because now central banks said, we're not using gold as money anymore. That's not really what happened. I mean, the reason Nixon had to go off the gold standard was precisely because central banks around the world, particularly France, were cashing in their dollars, and they wanted to acquire the gold, right? So it was, if anything, a desire to hold more gold that was putting pressure on the dollar, and that's what made Nixon throw in the towel. So so I think that's one thing. And then also it's really what we would want to do it correctly is look at the relative price of gold compared to some other things, right? So I think even if we did that second test, clearly gold would shoot up more than anything else during the 70s. But what I'm saying is, what Mises has in mind, I think, is that there's going to be a commodity money. Because remember, in the theory of money and credit, he's still agnostic as to whether there had ever been such a thing as a fiat money in human history to that point. Because even the period where specie redemption had been suspended, Mises just called that credit money, or said he thinks it's credit money, that we'd have to do more investigation. Right? So when Mises here is talking about the possibility of gold being demonetized, I don't think he has in mind the whole world going to pure fiat money, so that gold is no longer the money, because no commodity is just all fiat money. I don't think that's what he means. I think he's more thinking if there were some other commodity that began to be used as money replacing gold, in which case, you know, so I think that's part of it too, Lewis, that people really still are holding gold as the commodity money par excellence, even if governments around the world no longer officially recognize it as money. So it's sort of like that, you know, Ron Paul exchange with Ben Bernanke sort of represents the two viewpoints, that in one sense Bernanke was right that no, gold isn't money, what are you talking about? But in another sense, Ron Paul was right that gold really still is the market's money, and it's just been sort of beaten down and had fiat money forced on everybody's throats at gunpoint, basically. So I think that's another part of the story, too, to understand what Mises was talking about. But just to finish that train of thought that I brought up a couple minutes ago, I think to do it correctly, really what you'd want to say is it's the exchange value of gold relative to some other basket of commodities. And then to say if you switch from gold being money to something else being money, the value of gold would probably fall relative to that other basket. And because what happened in the U.S., it wouldn't be enough, in other words, just to say, oh, the dollar price of gold was 35 an ounce in 1970, and then in 1978 it was a lot higher than that, so therefore Mises' point doesn't hold, because the dollar price of everything went up, because they just started printing dollars like crazy. So really what you would want to do is to tease out, did the demonetization of gold reduce its exchange value? You'd want to specify the exchange value compared to what, and just comparing it to the paper currency isn't really the right measure. Because what you're trying to isolate is, once people are no longer trying to demand the gold in its role as being a medium of exchange, can we see that, oh, because of that drop in demand, now its price goes down. So like I said, even if we did it that way, you would still see the price of gold going up, right? So yeah, everything quoted in dollars got more expensive during the 1970s, but gold went up a lot more than bread did, or than whatever electricity did. Okay, but really good question there, Lewis. Okay, Lewis has another one about, quote, the element of continuity in the objective exchange value of money, end quote. So he's quoting there from Theory of Money and Credit. Could Mises' regression theorem be properly applied even in the case of fiat money, considering it never actually had a subjective use value in the same way that commodity money originally did and somehow still does? Even though back when most countries were on a gold standard, banknotes were legally and in practice redeemable in a certain weight of gold, is this ultimate link between paper and metal enough to establish a viable connection between the current unbacked fiat standard and the fundamentals of its legal origins, as opposed to a commodity standard that would naturally emerge from the market interactions? Okay. I think I'm understanding you, Lewis. So if you're asking how does the regression theorem apply to fiat money, if at all, then yeah, the standard Austrian view is the way you explain the purchasing power right now of a $20 bill or of a euro note is to say that historically, at one point, those things were tied to something else that we could definitely explain the purchasing power of as Austrians. And then that's what grounded people's expectations about the purchasing power of this particular thing, even when that link was removed. So for U.S. citizens in the year 1972, when the dollar at that point was a pure fiat currency, Austrians aren't embarrassed, and it's not like, oh, how do you Austrians explain that? You know, that's pretty straightforward. They just say, well, people remember the purchasing power it had last year. And then how do you explain that? Well, because at that point it was tied to gold, and we already know how to explain the purchasing power of gold. So yeah, that's – and then with the euro was never tied to gold, but the euro at one point, you know, had officially defined exchange ratios with the antecedent currencies like the lira and the franc and so forth. So that's how you would explain – the element of continuity in the objective exchange value of fiat currencies. So where this could come into play, so I actually don't remember Mises ever talking about that, and he wouldn't have had much of a time, right, because what, he died in 73 and Nixon closed the gold window in 71. So I don't know if Mises ever officially endorsed this escape hatch, if you will. But that's certainly how modern Austrians explain it, and like that's the standard explanation. So there's two things that occur to me. One is, since Mises in Theory of Money and Credit at least leaves open the possibility, the theoretical possibility of a fiat currency, it would be interesting if he ever explained how could that happen. And I guess I'm imagining he would just say, well, if they had a regular commodity-backed currency and then they suspended it and people started to think that they were never going to restore it, then it would be a fiat currency. And so I think he would be perfectly happy. You know, I think he would admit that was theoretically possible and just say that's not a violation of the regression theorem. The other thing is people talk a lot about Bitcoin, and that was one of the big arguments, was precisely how could Bitcoin be possible, because there wouldn't be that element of continuity. That if Bitcoin ever did become real popular and everybody's using it as money, well then, does that mean Mises was wrong with the regression theorem? So, I have given a lengthy answer that, for those who are curious, for Reddit Ask Me Anything thread that's like on my blog, or if you're my friend on Facebook, I put it there too. So there I spent about 15 minutes talking about Bitcoin. But anyway, for our purposes right now, and you guys can keep your eyes open when you're reading these sections in the theory of money and credit to see, is Mises really saying that it has to be the case that anything that's being used as money right now has this historical tie to a regular commodity? Because if he is saying that, then it looks like it's either Bitcoin or Mises, right? If Bitcoin ever catches on and becomes a money, well, then that means Mises was wrong. Or, you know, you could try to salvage it by saying, well, people originally were valuing the Bitcoin because of ideological reasons, and so it was a kind of like a consumption good, or, you know, you could do stuff like that. Incidentally, I see some people are posting questions in the Q&A part of this interactive, I forget what this is called, WebEx. Just go ahead and post the questions in the chat when we're doing this, the office hours, because there's a few number of you. So let me just not leave that person hanging. Jeff Leskovar says, did you see the National Review piece today about Austrian economics and Ron Paul by Ramesh Panur? If so, could you comment on it? I didn't actually, people have sent it to me. I just been real busy with stuff, so no, I didn't read it. And I've read that guy's stuff before, though. I mean, he's a real big fan of Scott Sumner with this, what's called market monetarism, which is, you know, they're saying that the Fed needs to print more, or not even that really. They're just saying the reason we're in the crisis right now is because nominal GDP has not been rising according to the historical trend, and so that total nominal incomes aren't rising fast enough for people to make their debt payments and stuff like that, and so they think that the Fed has fallen down on the job, and that Bernanke actually is not doing enough. And then that guy, he also talks about why the gold standard exacerbated the Great Depression, and I've written articles and stuff like on that at Mises.org, so I don't want to go over that again. So I think the guy's wrong, obviously, but the stuff in his article I've dealt with before. Okay. Sebring Sierra says, could you please explain the difference between the pre-1933 gold certificates? In other words, they look like the current U.S. currency but were payable on demand in gold, and our current form of currency, which looks essentially the same without the promise to be paid in gold. Sure. So, yeah, if you look at before I tell you to do something, let me see if it actually works. I know I've seen silver certificates, but let me see if there's a gold certificate and what it looks like. So yeah, if you go to, I even had this in one of my books. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't telling you something wrong. If you go to Wikipedia, for example, and look up gold certificate, you can see there's a thing that the $50 and $100 bills, and if you just, you know, click on it and see the zoom, you can see what they look like. And they look sort of like modern U.S. currency, except there's a few very important differences. So one thing is on the top, where today's notes say, let me see, not that I have a 50 in my wallet, I'm not that kind of rich, but I do have a 5, like Kramer from Seinfeld. Okay, so the top it says Federal Reserve note, whereas the gold certificate says at the top gold certificate, right? Appropriately enough. So that's one major difference. But then the other thing that really tips you off, so the thing nowadays, like this normal $5 bill, just says at the bottom $5, whereas the certificate, whether it's a gold certificate or they also had silver ones, says $50 in gold coin payable to the bearer on demand. Okay, so that's a very significant difference, whereas this thing doesn't say anything like that. So that's why I was saying in the beginning of this class that the fact that they call this a note is a little bit misleading, because generally speaking, a note is a claim on something, right? If you have a note, that's a claim allowing you, entitling you to get something. So, those are the distinctions in terms of the markings, and in practice, what's the distinction? Well, those certificates, you could go to, I don't know if it was a Treasury office or the Federal Reserve, but government offices, you could go in with those things and hand it over and say, okay, give me ounces of gold. And so before 1933, the exchange rate was $20.67 for an ounce of gold. And then after 33, it got revalued to $35 an ounce. So even that by itself right there is a dastardly move by the Roosevelt administration. They confiscated everybody's physical gold and paid them out $20.67 per ounce. And then the next year, they changed the price of gold to be $35 an ounce. So they, you get what I'm saying? So in other words, they like took everyone's gold and paid them $20.67 for it, and then next year declared anyone who's now sitting on physical gold, it's worth $35 an ounce. So that's a neat little way to make a tidy profit. That's a neat way to buy low and sell high. They bought the gold when it was at $20.67, and then they made it so the gold was now $35. That's kind of a neat gig if you can get it. So, Sebring, if you have something more you want me to elaborate on, you know, you can go ahead and type that in, and I'll come back around to it. But I'm not sure what else you want me to say. Okay, Jan asks, can you give us a brief history of leaving the gold standard? In other words, what changed? 1, when FDR left it. 2, Bretton Woods. 3, Nixon finished it. Sure. So, during the period of the classical gold standard, which was up until World War I, every major power linked its own currency to gold. So the United States, it was, when I say $20.67, I mean, that's roughly correct, like rounding to the nearest penny, but it wasn't that was a legally established ratio. It was, I'm not going to remember off the top of my head, but they, you know what I mean? In other words, the statute that stated it was different. Okay, so it's not like there was a statute that said $20.67. It was something else, like in terms of grams or grains of gold or silver. And then if you just did the calculations, it worked out to 2067. So that's one thing. Just be careful there that you understand that element of it if you go and read the actual history. And then with the let me grab my. Let me do a little commercial, and now a word from our sponsors. So here, I don't know if you can see it. This is my politically incorrect guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal, and I did give a little. See, and I even have the that gold $50 gold certificate in there. Okay. Yeah. So here's me talking. For example, when the United States abandoned the bimetallic system So when they were no longer using gold and silver and just went to gold, and formally went on a gold standard in 1900, it defined one U.S. dollar as 23.22 grains of gold. And that is equivalent to 1.505 grams. All right, so that's the way they actually, so, and it's, again, I mean, to understand, it wasn't like they were regulating the purchasing power of money or something as part of monetary policy. They were defining the dollar. Just like if they defined a foot as being 12 inches for the purposes of commerce, so that when merchants and their customers and other, you know, business people sign contracts with each other, if some people referred to feet and other people referred to inches, you know, legally we had to know what's the conversion ratio. And then so, you know, the government in its role as sort of promulgating a standard of weights and measures would say those sorts of things. And so that was the sense in which the government here is defining a dollar. It's not trying to use monetary policy to say, oh, we think we'll help employment and GDP growth if we stimulate, you know what I'm saying? It's back, their mindset was different. They were defining what the dollar was. They were defining it as 23.22 grains of gold. Okay, so the U.S. dollar was defined as that worked out to $20.67 for one troy ounce of gold, while the British pound was defined as 4.25 pounds to a gold ounce. Okay, so again, it was $20.67. So the U.S. government stood prepared, less small transaction fees and whatever, that anybody who came in and gave them $20.67, they would give you an ounce of gold, a troy ounce. And at the same time, the British government, this is pre-World War I, stood prepared that if you brought them 4.25 pounds, you know, like the British pound, their unit of money, then they would give you a gold ounce. And then, you know, the French government had their own thing, exchange ratio for the franc, and so on. So all the major governments were doing that. And so then that, in turn, implied fixed exchange rates between their respective currencies. So for example, if you go ahead and just, you know, do the division, the British pound had a fixed exchange rate of $4.86. In some places you'll see them say 4.87. It's just because it's, you know, it depends which way you round it to the US dollar, right? So $4.86 of US currency in the foreign exchange markets tended to trade for one British pound. And that was because of arbitrage, that if it deviated too far from that, then you could make money by, you know, going in one currency or the other and then exchanging it for gold and then taking the gold across the ocean and handing it into the other government and then getting your own currency back, if you see what I'm saying, right? So that's, so keep that in mind. And this was something that I didn't know. And Jan, I will come back to your question here. I'm sort of pontificating now. You don't want to interrupt me when I'm pontificating. This is something that I didn't understand until I got really deep into the Austrian literature. If you read Milton Friedman, for example, he has this famous essay on floating exchange rates. And he says, I'm paraphrasing, but he says something like, the free market economist is in favor of floating exchange rates, just like we're in favor of floating coffee prices, that we don't want governments setting price controls and saying their currency has to trade at a certain rate against other foreign currencies, because then that's a price control and just leads to either shortages or surpluses. So you read that Milton Friedman essay, and you're like, oh, yeah, what kind of dictatorial government would try to, you know, by law establish how much its own currency would trade against some other nation's currency in the foreign exchange market? That's crazy. That's a bunch of price fixing. That's something like Hugo Chavez does, not a free market kind of guy. But then Rothbard explains, no, that the historical classical gold standard did have fixed exchange rates. And it wasn't, though, it wasn't because the U.S. government said to its citizens, hey, if we catch you trying to pay more than $4.86 for one British pound, we're going to fine you or put you in jail. No, what the U.S. government said to its citizens was, if you bring us $20.67, we will give you an ounce of gold. Or if you want, if you give us an ounce of gold, we'll give you $20.67, again, less some transaction fees. At the same time, the British government was telling its citizens, if you bring us 4.25 pounds, we'll give you an ounce of gold, or vice versa. So given that Uncle Sam's doing that and that the British government or the Bank of England, whatever, are doing that, then that was a natural anchor for the British dollar exchange rate in the foreign exchange markets. So it wasn't a formal price control in the sense that it had to be backed up by guns. It was just that was the natural equilibrium point, because if it veered too far one way or the other, then there would be a gold flow from one country to the other. So that's what actually happened in the mid-20s. So after World War I, Britain wants to go back on the gold standard, just for the prestige of having the pound tied to gold, but they didn't want to face reality, because they had printed up a bunch of money during World War I to pay for the war effort. That's why they had to go off gold, because they would have, you know, just run out of gold. And so they wanted to go back to the pre-war parity. So if you've heard people use those phrases, maybe you've heard Hayek or Mises talk about this, that's what they're talking about. That they want to go back to having 4.25 British pounds exchanged for 1 ounce of gold. Whereas during the war years, the market price of gold was higher than 4.25 pounds. The pound had depreciated against gold because they were printing so many pounds. And that's why they had to go off the gold standard. But they wanted, for reasons of prestige and to sort of, you know, try to show that they hadn't defrauded their investors and whatever, they wanted to show the world, no, we had that little escapade with the war because, you know, give us a break, we were fighting for the fate of humanity and civilization against the Hun, but now we want to go back and honor our commitments to investors and whatever, so we're going to go back. But that was very difficult and painful because that would have required massive price deflation in Great Britain, and then the unions were agitating, and that's why the Federal Reserve in 1927 agreed that they were going to inflate to try to take pressure off of Britain. And so then you know, a lot of Austrians think that's what fueled the stock market bubble in the U.S., which led to the 29 crash. Okay, so anyway, back to your question, Jen. So between World War I and in the early 1930s, you had this really weird pseudo-gold standard where countries were kind of on the gold standard but not really, and Rothbard talks about it. I also mentioned it in my book. So it's a little bit misleading when people say, oh, the gold standard collapsed in the early 30s. That after World War I, the world never really had the classical gold standard anymore. It was always a sham from that point on. But anyway, what happened specifically in the United States in 1933, FDR, in one of his first acts, so he got sworn in March of 1933, so the election's in November of 1932, he beats Herbert Hoover. The inauguration wasn't in January like it is now. Back then, the U.S. president was inaugurated in March. And then one of his first acts, he tells everybody, you have to turn in your gold and turn in your gold certificates and all this stuff. And if you don't, we'll put you in jail or give you a huge fine. And then I'm pretty sure here, and I don't have the exact detail because I've never really seen a definitive source on this, but I think FDR, for several months at that point, so they went off the gold standard. So it's no longer, the U.S. dollar no longer is tied to $20.67 to gold. They just threw it out the window. And for a while, FDR was just picking the price of gold. Like, his advisors would come into him and say, what do you want the gold price to be? And he would literally just pick the number out of the air. Like, there's a guy who wrote in his diary saying, if anyone ever heard or found out about how we're setting the price of gold, you know, there'd be a panic, because this guy knew that FDR was just on whims saying, let's make it this price today. Let's make it this price. I mean, it's freaky. All right. So anyway, they then formally, I believe it was by 1934, just went and officially locked it back into being $35 an ounce. And then in Bretton Woods, which was in 1944, their big picture view, what happened is the U.S. government told all the other major powers, look, the U.S. dollar is going to be the new currency of the world. And so what we want you guys to do is don't tie your currencies to gold. You know, don't try to go back to the gold standard. The gold standard is dead. Right? We have a new era now. So what you should do, your central banks, you know, you have various assets, like you're holding your government bonds and stuff like that. Instead of you stockpiling gold, stockpile dollars, because that now is what everyone's going to want to hold. We've proven that, you know, we're now obviously the major superpower in the world, and we have a much better track record of wise monetary policy than you guys do. You know, we stayed on the gold standard pretty much during World War One, and so on. So, you know, you can trust us. If anything is going to be the world money at this point, it's going to be the U.S. dollar, so you guys stockpile that. But just to reassure you, we will still maintain gold reserves, and we will still keep the dollar tied to gold. So the point is, other countries would tie their currencies to the U.S. dollar, and they would, the way they could maintain those pegs was by stockpiling dollar-denominated assets, but the dollar, in turn, was still tied to gold at $35 an ounce. And then, so from 44 onward, the U.S. government stood prepared to redeem dollars for gold if they were presented by, like, a foreign central bank. But if just John Smith from down the street walked up to the Federal Reserve office and said, hey, I've got a bunch of paper dollars, give me some gold, they'd say, get out of here. But if the head of the French central bank showed up and said, I have $1 billion worth of you know, paper money, give me gold, then they would have to honor that. And then in 1971, Richard Nixon finally said, even that we can't do anymore, that nobody now can turn in dollars for gold. And the specific reasons for that were that, remember, in the 1960s, you had the Vietnam War and the so-called War on Poverty, where there was the, you know, a bunch of new social programs that were inaugurated. So the U.S. federal government was just spending a lot of money and running big deficits, and so they needed the Fed to monetize that debt, to, you know, print more money effectively and buy up those bonds. And so it was putting a lot of pressure on the U.S. dollar. And so other central banks were getting leery, particularly the Bank of France, and so they were sending the dollars saying, give us gold. And you know, by the late 1960s, the U.S. government had a choice. They could stop spending so much so that they wouldn't have to keep inflating and allow the dollar to, you know, allow its market price to go back to where now there wouldn't be this outflow of gold, or they could say, we're just going to give up the gold standard, and they opt for the second option. Okay. Lewis says, in line with my previous question, Theory of Money and Credit, page 110, Mises says, quote, this link with a pre-existing exchange value is necessary not only for commodity money, but equally for credit money and fiat money. Okay, well, great. That solves the problem. He did expressly say it. No fiat money could ever come into existence if it did not satisfy this condition. Okay, so that's pretty definitive. I know Mises has stuff in Human Action that makes it look like Bitcoin wouldn't, you know, either Bitcoin can't work or Mises is wrong. But it looks like, okay, he says stuff in even Theory of Money and Credit. I had forgotten that passage. Okay, so now this is Lewis talking again. Nevertheless, how is it possible to ever have attributed any ultimate exchange value to paper notes issued out of thin air when in practice the regular citizen could not actually redeem such banknotes for gold as is the case today? Could we say that to a certain extent fiat money is not at all money indeed? I mean, according to the Misesian framework, the banknotes we use today are merely fiduciary media, not even money substitutes in the original conception, since they're actually not claims on anything but paper itself. Okay, I think you're getting a little bit mixed up. I mean, I get what you're saying, Lewis, but I don't think you want to go that route. So in the original framework, what is fiduciary media? Fiduciary media means it's something, it's a claim on money that a bank issues for which there really is nothing backing it up. Right? So if a bank issues a bunch of claims on money and only some of them are backed up, then the excess ones are called fiduciary media, whereas the ones that are backed up are money certificates. And now, Lewis, I understand what you're saying. You're trying to say, well, in a sense, the fiat money right now, since it's not backed up by anything, is all fiduciary media, right? But I don't think that's a good way to think about it, because the fiat money right now doesn't purport to be a claim on anything. See, that's the distinction. Fiduciary media claims or says it's a claim on the money. So right now, there is fiduciary media in our society, in the United States and also in Europe, and that is your bank's checking account balance is not backed up 100% even by fiat money. You see? So you can have a system where there's commodity money and 100% reserve banking. So there's no fiat money and there's no fiduciary media. You can have a system where there's commodity money but fiduciary media, right, where gold, let's say, is the money, but then banks will issue checkbook balances in excess of the amount of physical gold in the vault. So there, some of those claims on the money are excess of the fiduciary media. You can have, logically, you can imagine a society where they have fiat money but 100% reserve banking. So the actual money is just pieces of paper that the king issues, and it's not backed up by anything. But it doesn't claim to be representing it. It just says, nope, this is it. It's a picture of the king. It's 10 ducats or something. And then the commercial banks in that world, though, practice 100% reserve banking. So that if you bring 1,000 ducats worth of paper notes and deposit it to your bank, and then they give you your checkbook that says 1,000 ducats, and you're going around writing checks, the bank's not lending those out to anybody. It's 100% reserve banking. So everybody who has a debit card, there are that many paper ducats in the vault of the bank. So it's fiat money, but it's 100% reserve banking. So there's fiat money, but no fiduciary media. And then finally, you can have what we have, which is fiat money and fiduciary media. So the actual base money is fiat. It's not a claim to a commodity. And on top of that, the commercial banks inflate. And so they issue more claims to money than there actually is fiat money in the vault. All right, so that's how screwed up our system is. So I get what you're saying, that you want to call the fiat money fiduciary media because it's not backed up, but I think that's not the right way to think about it, because it's fiduciary media present themselves as claims, and then we're saying it's just there's more claims than there are things to be claimed. Whereas fiat money doesn't even purport to be a claim. Okay. Lewis has some more questions, but let me skip around Lewis because some other people haven't talked about their questions yet. We'll see if we have time. We've got about 7 minutes left. Matthew T. says, in terms of the current situation, I often hear people say that even though the Fed is printing a lot of money, it's not getting into the economy, but rather staying in the banks as they're not lending it out, and corporations are also keeping large cash balances. Is this true, and if so, what do you think the effects of this could be? Yeah, it is true. So if you look through my archives, Matthew, I've talked about a lot of this stuff. For example, one that was recently linked to, it's called On the Brink of Inflationary Disaster or something. And it was from August of 2011. So there I lay out, if you want to go and see the specifics. Unfortunately, I'm once again crying wolf there, that there I was warning people that, okay, maybe now the price inflation is about to be unleashed, and obviously it's not like the world's collapsed since then. So my critics are pointing to that and saying, yep, you screwed up again, Bob. So anyway, with that caveat, though, I do lay out the basic position of both sides of the debate. So very quickly, what's happening is since the fall of 2008, Ben Bernanke purchased a lot of assets from the market, mortgage-backed securities and government bonds, most notably, and put them on the Fed's balance sheet. So for him to do that, he created money out of thin air, just wrote checks to people and gave it to them, created that money out of thin air. They went and deposited it in their bank accounts. So now their banks have reserve balances with the Fed that are much higher than they were in 2007. So that's what's called the monetary base has more than doubled just in the last 3 years. Yeah, 3.5 years, whatever. So, but more conventional measures of like the money stock held by the public, like if you add up the amount of physical paper cash in people's wallets and their checking account balances, that's what's called M1, that hasn't gone up as much. That's gone up, but it hasn't gone up as much. And so the reason for that discrepancy is what you're saying. The banks right now have more than $1 trillion of excess reserves. So they could make new loans if they wanted to, but they don't want to. So in a sense, it's loosely speaking, you could say Bernanke created roughly $1 trillion, gave it to the bankers, and they're sitting on it. And so that's why you haven't seen the price of bread go to $10 a loaf, because the bankers aren't stockpiling bread. But you do see the price of gold and other commodities going up because, you know, the bankers speculating on price inflation, that's a good inflation hedge, whereas you're not going to go buy bread or eggs as an inflation hedge. Yeah, so Sebring says, it seems that this is an incorrect description to call it a Federal Reserve note since it's not redeemable on anything. Yeah, you're right. I mean, they should just call it Federal Reserve, I don't know what, paper or something, Federal Reserve asset. I don't know what they call it, Federal Reserve unit of money, but it's not really a note because you can't turn it in for anything. So you are right that that's a little bit misleading. And that is the sense, I guess it was it Jan who was asking me? I'm getting mixed up now who was asking me. No, maybe Lewis. When I say the fiat money doesn't purport to be a claim to anything, I mean legally speaking. If you do inspect the thing, it does say Federal Reserve note, and that's a throwback to the time when it really was a bank note. Because remember, historically, even just regular private commercial banks could issue bank notes. And that was ultimately a claim, an instantly payable on-demand claim to whatever the actual money was. And those things would circulate as money substitutes. And so, but typically central banks monopolize the issue of bank notes. So nowadays, that sounds weird to us. We can't imagine people holding things in their wallets that were issued by just regular commercial banks. But that's only because central banks have monopolized the issue of bank notes. Okay, I got about time for one more question. Let me see, I think I got everything, and I'll circle back to Lewis, had one more. If I'm missing anybody's question, just go ahead and post it for this week in the questions for the professor week 3, on Moodle, and I will eventually, when I circle back, I'll get it if I'm missing it tonight. Okay, Lewis says, Mises claims that, quote, for the law, the invariability of the value of money is not a fiction but a fact, end quote. And below, he goes on to clearly state that, quote, in its naive belief in the stability of the value of money, the law is in complete harmony with public opinion, end quote. And further that, quote, the value of gold currencies is still regarded as stable, end quote. Did he really believe that statesmen and lawmakers were in fact unaware of the fluctuations in the objective exchange value of commodity money, even under the gold standard, were citizens in general also indifferent towards such a crucial issue? And what's worse, how come this all seems to hold true even to this day whenever we attempt to make a case for sound money? I asked Guido Holtzman about this, Lewis, when I was writing the study guide, because you could understand in 1912 Mises saying that, but then he had, you know, an updated version, and I'm getting a little mixed up as to what pages I was looking, but there was, I'm pretty sure he was saying things like that after the German hyperinflation would have happened. And so I was asking Guido, what is Mises talking about? Even at this point, he's saying that people, the average businessman still thinks that money is, stable, and that you can make long-term plans on your books and not worry about the price of your inputs going up. And, and I don't remember his exact response, but Guido said something like the German people just kind of thought that was a one-time disaster, and that, once they got through that, okay, now we're back to where, money is a measure of value, and just like a meter stick doesn't change, it just objectively measures length. By the same token, money measures value, gosh darn it. And so when I write stuff in my accounting books, my balance sheet or whatever, that's a measurement. So that's the way Mises or Guido explained it. Because remember, in fairness, so Lewis, to answer your question, yeah, Mises does think that people believe that, and I think they did believe that, more or less. Because remember, prices were pretty stable when countries were on the classical gold standard. That, the amount of goods and services that one U.S. dollar could buy in 1820 was basically the, well, I don't want to say 1920 because there was World War I. Let's say in 1810 was basically the same as it was in 1910. I mean, yeah, some things went up, but other things went down. It's not like we are familiar with us growing up and our parents saying, oh, when I was a kid, going to a movie theater cost whatever. And nowadays, look how expensive it is. You know what I mean? So nowadays, the last three generations, people are, it's just a fact of life that prices go up year after year after year. But that wasn't true on the classical gold standard. Prices didn't go up year after year back then. And so it was not surprising, or we shouldn't be shocked, that Mises is saying the average business person thinks that money is an objective measuring rod of value, because it kind of was. I mean, so Mises was being more theoretical there and saying, no, I know, because I understand subjective value theory, that there is no such thing as an objective unit, quantitative unit of value. And so there couldn't be. And even with gold, as much as we revere gold, it too fluctuates in its exchange value vis-a-vis everything else. And that you're fooling yourself if you think that defining everything in reference to weights of gold has therefore given you this immutable measurement of value per se. Right? So it's kind of funny here. Mises is almost trying to show people why gold isn't the perfect money that they think it is, even though Mises is a champion of gold. So that's what's going on in those pages. So just remember the context, especially when he first wrote this in 1912. At that point, I mean, people knew that there had been inflations during wars, but they kind of thought that was just this weird anomaly. And then especially if the governments went back to the pre-war parity, then, things went back to normal. So to answer your question, yeah, Mises really does think people believe that. I think he was right to say that. Okay, well, I got to stop there. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in, and I'll see you next week.